Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Wyoming legislative session wrapped up this week, and three issues dominated. One was the state budget, another was the legislature's decision to reject federal dollars to expand Medicaid, and the final issue was the Supreme Court decision that said it was unconstitutional for the legislature to demote State Superintendent Cindy Hill. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck asked lawmakers about some of those issues and has this report.
This was a budget session, and that made the budget the focus of legislators. And while those in the Republican leadership raved about it, others weren't so sure. Republican Representative Albert Summers of Pinedale is finishing up his first term.
I thought last year was fast. You know, I felt like my hair was going back on the side of my head. And this session, I thought it was ripping off my head. You know, it was that fast.
Summers was particularly overwhelmed by the wide range of issues lawmakers had to address. And he says the budget was particularly overwhelming.
And I don't think we spend enough time on our budget amendments to really get a good handle on what we're voting on and what we're trying to do.
Things have slowed down for Laramie Representative Kathy Connolly, who's gone through a couple of terms, but she joins other Democrats in complaining that a lot of money was saved and not enough was done for people.
I would have liked to see more money for state employees' raises. I would have liked to have seen, although it wouldn't have cost us any money, more commitment to Medicaid expansion. We do have the amendment that's in the budget bill that allows the governor now to do a little bit of that kind of negotiation, but I would have liked to have seen a bit more with that.
Fellow Democrat Bernadine Kraft says not getting Medicaid expansion was the biggest disappointment of the session. The senator from Rock Springs says even though there is a budget amendment, she does not think anything will be done.
No, I really don't. I mean, we have opened the door for the governor to talk to CMS, to the Center for Medicaid Studies, but we haven't given him any power whatsoever. So I don't know how we can expect him to do anything.
As for the budget, Kraft did see some positives.
Most especially the funding for local governments, for cities, towns, and counties. We were able to successfully amend into the budget the extra funding for senior centers, which was also a critically important item in pretty much all parts of our worlds, and particularly in mine. So I felt very good about that.
As for Medicaid expansion, fellow Senator Larry Hicks, who's a Republican from Bags, expressed the concern of many Republicans who fear that the federal government may not live up to its obligation to pay for the expansion. But Hicks also wonders about using any government money to pay for such services. He admits it's a difficult issue for him.
Obviously, there's a need for this. I think that's why we saw the House at least say, let's take a hard look at it. Once we know what the rules of the game are, let's be prepared to jump in. So I think there was a lot of people that scattered on the Medicaid. I think, you know, we all understand the compassion and the charity, but it's how you go about that is where a lot of the debate ranges.
Back in the House, Worland Republican Michael Greer says Medicaid expansion is also a tough issue for him.
Most of my people back home don't want Medicaid expansion. I believe that's because they don't understand the gap that's created without Medicaid expansion.
While Greer understands the need, he says it would have been difficult for him to vote for it due to the response of his constituents. As for the other underlying issue, what to do about Superintendent Cindy Hill, Greer wishes it would just go away. But he says they'll probably have to do something.
It's going to be a rocky 9 or 10 months here, plain and simple. Will we need to come back for a special session? I personally hope not, but if we do, you know, that's part of our job. And, you know, I know there's budget issues and a lot of statutes that are affected, and if we need to come down here for 3 days or whatever it takes to get that cleaned up, that's what we'll have to do.
Senator Kraft says the Hill issue is a mess.
That's been so tragic. It's eclipsed the session. It's eclipsed a lot of constituents' view of the legislature, and it's been sad.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
We just heard legislators discussing some of the issues of the past session, but we also chatted with some who attended the session. Wyoming Public Radio intern Aaron Jones got some reaction from a variety of onlookers.
Yeah, my name's Carrie Drake. I live in Casper. I've covered the sessions back, clear back to 1977. I'm very disappointed in some of the fairly right-wing extreme opinions that are being expressed in the House. I don't think that necessarily translates to what the average person in Wyoming feels, particularly on the Medicaid expansion issue, which is what I've been covering the most. They're not looking out for the people in Wyoming. They're looking out for their own political careers. They have enough money to do basically what they came down to do, so it's not as contentious as most sessions are. Everybody seems on edge. They seem to want to get out of here. I'm with them. I want to get out of here, too.
I'm Bruce Hinchy with the Petroleum Association of Wyoming. I'm from Casper. Well, it's a little bit better than last year. Last year there was a lot of discontent with everyone. At least I don't see people nearly as irritated with each other this year as they were last year.
Randy Dice. I'm the mayor of Buffalo, Wyoming, and so I'm just over here rocking the Capitol. It's just a great opportunity to get to witness how this all works, and I enjoy coming down here. That's what this is for. It's for us to, you know, root out everything that we don't like or root things in that we do like. This is our system. It works good.
My name is Cindy Pomeroy, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Oh, I think it's going fairly well. I think it's always hard work for the legislators that come down here and try to do a lot of work in 20 days, and they're always well-intended and do the best they can, and I think Wyoming has the greatest system in the country.
Shannon Anderson. I lobby for Powder River Basin Resource Council. We're a statewide conservation group based in Sheridan. This is my, I think, sixth session down here, so I've been lobbying a number of years down here in Cheyenne. You know, the budget sessions are always so fast and furious. Legislators work incredibly hard and long hours to get the budget done, which is always the priority. There's also, you know, share of controversy, too, I think, that seems to have a flavor of the session a little bit. All of those kind of big picture questions that the state's facing right now, just the way that coal may not be as an important source of revenue in the future. Some of those big questions, I think, have also been giving an overarching flavor to the session.
Sydney Smith, Sheridan, Wyoming. It's my first time here, and so I'm really excited to come intern here in the future. Now that I've kind of seen what it's about and seen like all the lobbyists and the senators, this is what I want to do.
When we come back, we'll continue discussing the past legislative session with outgoing House Speaker Tom Lubnow. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Outgoing Speaker of the House Tom Lubnow says he is wrapping up his legislative career. The Gillette Republican is a fierce advocate for coal and the extractive industries. Speaker Lubnow also has had some strong views recently about the University of Wyoming and got national attention over his reaction to the infamous carbon sink sculpture that was placed near Old Main at UW. We pick up our conversation with Lubnow discussing his mindset at the time.
Well, if your 75% of your dollars come from the extractive industries, maybe it's not a good idea to put up an anti-extractive industry sculpture. And it wasn't about the sculpture or the dialogue that the sculpture caused. I think that that's important. But I guess if sometimes that dialogue isn't what people want to hear, that creates a fervor nationwide.
Been an awful lot of money put towards the University of Wyoming. This session is certainly no exception, where the focus has been on energy, a lot more energy research. There are some that have wondered if the focus has been too much on that, and should we also have a focus and funding for diversifying our economy more?
Energy is our bread and butter. And so what we have to do is focus on excellence in that area and then take those subsidiary spin-offs from the energy industry and expand into those. But you have to start somewhere and pick one area of excellence. Well, where our money comes from seems to be the area to concentrate on. This session, we had some things that just kind of slipped through quietly. Where we're trying to now
look at those value-added processes and think long-term about how to attract value-added processes so that we can fundamentally change our economy.
Speaker of the House Tom Lubnow is visiting with us. I want to ask you one more university-related question. One of the things that has come up is recently some on campus are concerned. The legislature, frankly, has, I think the term I hear is micromanaging. What's your response to that?
I don't think it's micromanaging, but if you're writing a $420 million check, there is some responsibility to make sure that the $420 million is being spent wisely. If the university didn't want the $420 million check, then probably there wouldn't be any legislative involvement.
I think they want the check, but at the same time, aren't they the experts in education?
That's true. They are the experts in education, and they should be responsible for educating their students. But shouldn't they want to say to the legislature, these are the results that we're trying to achieve, and this is where we're going to go, and this is how we're being good stewards of your money? And that's all the legislature wants. Politically, the University of Wyoming has dug itself into a hole. And you see it with the community colleges, because the state representatives represent all different areas of the state. And so each of the community colleges, the seven community college districts, have created constituencies within the legislature. And so 10 years ago, the community colleges were self-sufficient. Now about $300 million of the state's budget is going to community colleges because they've worked to have legislators understand where the money goes, the value from the community colleges. And frankly, politically, the community colleges have outpaced the University of Wyoming in funding. And so the University of Wyoming hasn't done that. They've worked in many ways to shun the legislature. And so their constituency amounts to four representatives and two senators who represent Albany County now. And so without developing the relationships with the legislators, it's going to be more and more difficult for the university to get funding just because of the nature of votes on the floor.
I'm aware that presidents were very active over here and were talking, so things did change at some point.
You can have a university president over here chatting and visiting and coming out and visiting with the legislators one time a year. But in terms of developing advocates for the university on the legislative floor, they've been outpaced by the community colleges, and to the tune of about $300 million. Now, that isn't to say, I mean, we spent $1 billion at the University of Wyoming over the last 10 years. It's not that we haven't been generous, but unless the university thinks about its future and works to develop those relationships, and you've got some good people doing that, but it can't be just top management. It has to be folks who work at the University of Wyoming. And we tried an effort with a budget amendment to try and get folks, the deans, introduced to the standing committees, because what happens is once you have that relationship, those standing committees become advocates for the university. There was some misguided language in that budget amendment that got misconstrued. But the whole purpose of that budget amendment was to allow the university an opportunity to develop a relationship with the legislators so that they had more advocates on the floor.
Speaking of education, before I let you go, obviously what's dominated your life probably in the last year or so has been Superintendent Cindy Hill. You had the legislation to strip powers away. We all know the Supreme Court said that that was unconstitutional. Regrets about that at all?
No, as a legislator, you make the best choice, the best decision on the facts that you had at the time. We had a Department of Education that was in crisis. We had employees complaining about atmospheres of secrecy and intimidation and bizarre behaviors like videotaping people at meetings and then disciplining those people at the meetings for improper body language. We had allegations that funds were being misused. The one thing about Senate File 104 that nobody discusses is that what we did worked. For the first time in as long as I can remember, we'd taken politics out of education.
One last thing. Are we going to see a special session and go back and try and fix this?
I don't know the answer to that. I think it's too early to tell.
Tom Lubnow, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
When we come back, we'll take a look at what Wyoming's congressional delegation is saying about President Obama's proposed budget, and we'll hear about an effort to map out wildlife migration routes around the state. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This week, President Barack Obama unveiled his budget, which the Wyoming congressional delegation says would cripple the state's economy. Matt Laszlo has the details from Washington.
Republicans in Congress fought tooth and nail in one of the last spending battles to get deep spending cuts to most every federal program, save the military. The president's budget flips that equation basically on its head. He's calling for shrinking the number of U.S. combat troops, while increasing funding for his domestic priorities, including everything from education to his signature health care law.
At a time when our deficits are falling at the fastest rate in 60 years, we've got to decide if we're going to keep squeezing the middle class or if we're going to continue to reduce the deficits responsibly while taking steps to grow and strengthen the middle class.
Wyoming Republicans are rejecting the budget out of hand. Senator John Barrasso says the president only wants spending increases in order to expand the role of Washington in people's lives.
The president likes his budget and his government supersized. That's what we see with the things that he's proposed in there.
In this election year, Barrasso says it's evident the White House laid out a campaign document that has no chance of being implemented.
To me, the budget is not going to pass. It's even the Democrats have said that. I'm not sure the Democrats are even going to vote for it.
With the nation's debt sitting at more than $17 trillion, Barrasso says he wishes the president had focused on long-term solutions. The president removed an entitlement reform proposal that Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis liked. Called Chain CPI, it saves billions by readjusting how seniors' Social Security payments are calculated.
I was very pleased that a year ago that the president saw that it is important to use proper accounting methods to measure inflation in this country.
Lummis says last year the president showed courage by confronting his liberal base with a proposed reform to entitlements. That's why she's disappointed he changed his stance during this election year.
And then the president thereby backing away as well is a reflection of how jittery Democrats are right now.
As you might expect, Democrats see it quite differently. Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly says the president would be foolish to offer the same proposal as an olive branch again, because Republicans never offered anything in return for it.
He did have the chain CPI in the last budget. Look where it got him. It sort of alienated the Democratic base and got him nothing with the Republican base. And so taking it off the table, I think, is a very logical response to the lack of response by the Republican majority.
Then there's energy policy. The president is once again asking to increase funding for the Environmental Protection Agency.
And we know that future generations will continue to deal with the effects of a warming planet. So this budget proposes a smarter way to address the costs of wildfires. And it includes over $1 billion in new funding for new technologies to help communities prepare for a changing climate today and set up incentives to build smarter and more resilient infrastructure.
Lummis says the relentless effort to increase regulations by this White House shows a disregard for energy states like Wyoming.
It would shackle our region. Its heavy emphasis on environmental regulation, on climate change funding, in a way that clamps down on the manner in which we produce energy, it would be quite devastating.
Lummis says the scheduled closing of the Simpson unit at the Wyodak Power Plant in Gillette is an example of the impact the new budget would have on the state.
10 full years before its useful life ends, all because of federal regulations, that it's going to increase the price of electricity for its customers, and it is going to create potentials for electricity shortages. That's not smart.
Each year, Congress receives the White House budget, and then lawmakers lay out their own budget priorities. As far as Wyoming lawmakers are concerned, this year's budget is dead on arrival. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Wyoming has some of the longest wildlife migration routes in the U.S. Animals travel in some cases over 100 miles from summer ranges to winter habitats. Protecting the migration routes is important for maintaining healthy populations. But land managers and other decision makers often don't actually know where the animals travel. Now scientists are tracking their routes. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
That's the sound of mule deer migrating. They walk single file along a sandy streambed, pausing occasionally to look around. The audio is from footage that National Geographic photographer Joe Reese took near the Wind River Range. He and a team of scientists have been documenting the trip these deer take between their summer and winter habitats. It's part of a project called the Wyoming Migration Initiative. Matt Kaufman at the Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit is one of the people in charge.
Migration is essentially the way these animals, you know, make a living in Wyoming.
In other words, migration is critical to their survival. The animals fatten up in the summer on nutritious plants in the mountains. In the winter, the snow is too deep for them to stay, so they have to travel to lower elevations. But their routes in between can get blocked by development. Fences go up, oil and gas wells are drilled, roads are built.
If those migration routes were cut off, then it's going to be much harder for these animals to make a living. And we should expect that populations will diminish and will become smaller.
Everyone from energy companies to environmental groups say they want to protect healthy migratory populations. But that's hard because they don't always know where the migration routes are. Kaufman launched the Migration Initiative to find out.
The broader goal of the initiative is to start to understand where are the corridors, where are the most important ones, the ones that are used by the most animals, and which are the ones that are most threatened.
Kaufman's team is using data from GPS collars to map the paths that the animals follow. But the project isn't just about collecting data. It's also about getting that data to the right people.
The typical model is that when research is done by a specific researcher, they own the data and it sits, you know, on their servers, in their database systems. And someone else who's working on that same chunk of land, they might not even know that the data exists, or they might know it exists but don't have access to it.
In contrast, the migration info will end up in a database. The BLM, the Game and Fish Department, energy companies, and environmental organizations will all have access. Julia Stubel with the Wyoming Outdoor Council says having that data will help her group's conservation efforts.
This kind of data shows us where a corridor might be or where the stopover points on the corridor, where the animals stop and forage. And that those are the places we need to actually focus on.
State and federal agencies also have plans for the data. Dennis Seville with the BLM says it will help create land use plans that are wildlife friendly. He says in the past, they took summer and winter ranges into consideration.
But a lot of times we might not know what the movements between those ranges would be, and land use plans might have went ahead and delineated areas in between that might be very important for wildlife, but they might have identified him as, you know, wide open for oil and gas leasing with very few restrictions.
Seville says there are additional ways the BLM could use the migration information.
We're getting more and more of these large-scale projects that send a pipeline, you know, from, say, Casper all the way to Oregon, or a transmission line, you know, from wind developments down in Rawlins all the way to Las Vegas, you know. So it would help, at least on the Wyoming side of that scale, to know, are these projects being placed in the path of migrating animals that way? And if so, where? And is there a way we can modify those things?
Even agencies like Game and Fish, which do a lot of wildlife research themselves, say the initiative will help. Bob Lanka is in charge of biological services for the department.
To be able to pull all these data sets into one place and be able to view them in GIS format is a very, very powerful tool compared to what we used to have to do where you drew lines on a piece of mylar, overlaid that on a map, and said they kind of moved through here.
The database is expected to be up and running within a year, and after that, researchers plan to publish a migration atlas for the general public. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Bentley Spang is an artist in residence with the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Wyoming. His current exhibit at the UW Art Museum is charcoal rubbings from trees burnt in the 2012 Ash Creek wildfire on the family ranch on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweizer asked Bentley Spang about the experience.
After the fire, I spent a lot of time cleaning up the place. You know, we lost the house And I was trying to make sense of the fire as well. You know, I just had a lot of emotion about the place as I was cleaning it up. And there were the trees, and the trees are really what frame your sort of existence there. It just came to me that they needed to be able to express what happened to them.
So the tree is the medium.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I've heard you talk about your grandmother's and your father's respect for trees.
My grandma Jenny, she would always say, "Oh, that's a good one." She would be looking at these old trees, you know, and especially the old dead trees. I asked my dad about that, and he said, "Oh, she's admiring, you know, that it's lived that long, but also that's a lot of firewood, you know. So, you know, it's a realistic look, but it's also an admiration of that natural world."
On Fire is such an interesting collection of work because the pieces are really beautiful. And wildfires are very complex, too, because on the one hand, they are good for the land, but they're also very tragic when they actually do happen. And so there is that kind of duality in the work that I see as well.
Yeah, the initial kind of thing is devastation, you know. My parents lived in that house for 31 years, and so a lot of memories there. Then after you sort of get a handle on that, then, you know, you're on a ranch and you have horses and you have to keep those horses alive. And that was the next challenge, you know, so it was the fire after the fire, you know. All our grazing was gone, you know, the hay was pretty scarce. So, you know, it was just challenge after challenge after challenge. But then the next spring, we got, you know, pretty heavy rains and stuff, and it came back in such an amazing way, you know, the plants and stuff. You know, I was thinking, you know, there's going to be a sort of a first generation of plants that are kind of limited that'll come back, and, you know, it'll take time for all of them to come back. No, they all came back. You know, I mean, most of the ones that I'm used to seeing and interacting with and the ones that are important to us as Cheyenne people, those came back. And so that's what, you know, you see in the piece is that sort of transition from total devastation to kind of, you know, this new rebirth.
The show is interesting because you have these charcoal rubbings, paper and charcoal, but you also have a video installation happening at the same time. And I see in a lot of your work that you like to mix media. I mean, you've done pieces in the past that mix like metal with animal sinew.
Well, you know, really it comes out of my interaction with the work of my relatives in the past. And they weren't afraid to, you know, mix it up. There was no sense of, oh, this isn't appropriate or it's not traditional. Now, it's what they would say today.
Now, you tackle this issue of tradition and innovation, which you don't see as being mutually exclusive. But you tackle this in these techno powwows that you've done. You've done two of them so far. You're going to be doing a third techno powwow at the University of Wyoming. And this is this fascinating thing that combines video installation with Native American and other dance forms and techno and hip-hop music. And then you are the MC, your alter ego is the MC, Blue Guy, the Indian of the future. Can you tell me about him?
The Blue Guy is sort of this unbridling of, you know, this part of my personality that has a tendency to get shut down by society. And it's also a reaction to those sort of one-dimensional depictions of us in the movies and in books and stuff over the years. You know, we get just a couple of dimensions, you know. The angry young Indian male, you know, or female, the mystical shaman, the noble chief. So it's all these one-dimensional takes on our experience. And so really it was a reaction and continues to be to some of that. But it's also like it's really, you know, you do really never hear Indian and future in the same sentence. I mean, honestly. And also this character is sort of has that underpinning of clowning. And clowns are about really leveling the playing field so that no one got too egotistical. That's kind of what the character's doing as well, is trying to level the societal playing field, you know, in terms of how we're perceived as Native people. And in the techno powwow, it's just about mixing up these different cultures, you know, within this framework of dance and music, and seeing how similar they are to each other. And, you know, hopefully, you know, it's going to blow the doors off again. I just know it will. Once you get all those talented, you know, passionate dancers in the same room, it just happens.
To me, it seems that Native Americans are often portrayed and viewed as outside of mainstream society. And so this is a really interesting blending.
Yeah, that's what's really nice about it, is to have a breakdancer, you know, from sort of today's world react to a powwow dancer and vice versa.
What kind of audience reactions do you get?
You know, at first I don't think they knew what to think in the second one. But, you know, this thing is really for all ages. You know, we really try to build this energy that you can't resist. Like at a rave, you know, you stand on the sidelines when you first get there, and the next thing you know, that music just and the drum beat just draws you out there. Same thing with powwow. It pulls at you. It gets inside of you, and it just sort of, you know, grabs you and pulls you.
Bentley Spang, thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Great to be here. Thanks.
Bentley Spang, On Fire, is on display at the UW Art Museum through March 22nd. Techno Powwow 3 is scheduled for April 2nd at the Union Ballroom.
When we come back, we'll talk with the producer of a documentary about the Lincoln Highway. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Lincoln Highway is 100 years old this year, and Wyoming PBS will be screening a new documentary about it this weekend. Much of what was the Lincoln Highway in Wyoming is now Interstate 80, but parts of the original route are still separate. The film tells the story of the highway in Wyoming. Producer Tom Manning joins us now. He says the Lincoln Highway holds an important place in Wyoming's history and in the history of the U.S. as a whole.
The Lincoln Highway was the first transcontinental highway across America. It was inaugurated in October of 1913, and it went from New York City to Times Square, New York City, to San Francisco, and it covered 3,300 miles. It went through 12 states, 4 time zones. It was quite the deal in 1913.
So give us a little bit of the history here. Where did the first idea to make a coast-to-coast highway come about?
Right. Well, a chap by the name of Carl Fisher owned a company called Prestolite, and he made acetylene headlights for early automobiles. He was also the founder of the Indianapolis 500 Raceway. So Carl Fisher was kind of a dreamer, and he had this idea in 1912 for what he called the Coast-to-Coast Rock Highway. He wanted to see a highway come across the United States. He thought the country was ready for it, but also he wanted to sell auto parts. So he pitched this idea to a bunch of auto executives in 1912, and among them, he must have had one heck of a pitch line, because Frank Seiberling, who was president of Goodyear Tires, immediately pledged $300,000. This is 1913 dollars. Henry Joy, who was the president of Packard Motor Company, pledged $150,000. It was Fisher's idea to have about $10 million to get this highway done across America. So in about 3 months' time, he had almost $5 million. And that was the genesis of it. And then Henry Joy came along to him and said, Coast-to-Coast Rock Highway, why not call it the Lincoln Highway in honor of Abraham Lincoln? So this was the first true memorial to Lincoln, because the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C. was still a dream that hadn't been built yet.
Now, in the trailer for this film, you say that this road changed America forever. That's a kind of a bold statement. How did it do that?
It is a bold statement, but I think it's a true statement. I mean, this was the beginning of auto tourism. For the first time, people could go where they wanted to go on their own schedule, and actually get out of their own towns and drive to different cities. Heretofore, they had to take the train to do that. No, at first the road wasn't great. There were, you know, in Wyoming, they had terrible problems with mud in the spring, not just Wyoming, throughout the run of the Lincoln Highway. Eventually, as the road started to improve, people started traveling further and further. And so this was the whole beginning of auto tourism in America, and everything that we see along the roads today was because of the Lincoln Highway. The motel started with the Lincoln Highway. At first, people stayed with ranch families here in Wyoming in the very, very early days. These ranch families went, well, maybe we should build a few cabins and see what happens. And those got occupied quickly. And then that spun off to, well, let's make this a little bit bigger. So I think the epitome of this can be seen in Little America out towards Rock Springs. Little America started near Granger, Wyoming, because of the Lincoln Highway. And he started out small. It was Stephen Mack Covey who started it. And he started out small. He started out with a few cabins. He had a coffee shop. Soon he put in a cocktail lounge called the Palm Room. Then he put in some gas pumps. And it grew and grew and grew until he had a little empire. And so motels were a result of the Lincoln Highway. Fast food is a result of the Lincoln Highway. Howard Johnson started with his 28 flavors of ice cream stands along the Lincoln Highway. White Castle Hamburger started because of the Lincoln Highway. So there's some good aspects to it, and there's also, you know, some, I don't know how people feel about fast food, but, you know, there's some negative aspects to it too. It kind of lent itself to the homogenization of American cities somewhat, but certainly not in the early days. Part of the deal of the Lincoln Highway, unlike the interstate that replaced it, was that it went through the main streets of cities along the way. And that's how Cheyenne 16th Street got the name Lincoln Way, because it went right through the center of Cheyenne.
So we've talked about how this road changed sort of the way people travel and got people to see parts of the country that they might never have gotten to, or certainly not by car before. What else? I mean, did it do other things for Wyoming? I could imagine that it could have helped bring extra business in from outside.
Absolutely. It was really the beginning of the tourism industry in Wyoming, which today is a, you know, huge, huge part of the state's economy. People basically, you know, after 1913 and through the 20s and the 30s, tourism really started to pick up in Wyoming, and all kinds of businesses, you know, that we mentioned earlier started to spring up. If you travel the Lincoln Highway between Laramie and Rawlins, that's the old US 30, it goes through Medicine Bow and all those little communities, Rock River along the way, you can still see remnants of the Lincoln Highway establishments along that road.
Tom Manning is the producer for 100 Years on the Lincoln Highway, which premieres March 9th on Wyoming PBS. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Willow. Thanks.
And now an installment from our StoryCorps recordings. Wyoming writer C.J. Box and his daughter Molly Donnell talk about one of their favorite pastimes, fly fishing. Box is a self-taught avid fly fisherman, and from the time his daughters were very young, he was intent on teaching them about the sport, too. He remembers the first time he handed his daughters fishing rods.
The first memory I have wasn't actually fishing, but you and your twin sister, Becky, thought it was. And I think you were probably 3 or 4, and I got you some Mickey Mouse fishing poles. And after a big, heavy rain, I took you guys out on the front sidewalk and showed you how to put the line. I think they were little rubber balls on the end that put the rubber balls in the water, and then I would cheer as you caught imaginary fish, and both of you really got excited about that. And I thought it kind of laid out my secret plan for the rest of my life and yours, and that was to raise girls who fished.
I can say from my perspective, growing up as a girl and having a dad that never at any point made me feel like I was lacking in anything or missing out on anything, has been wonderful for me to discover how wonderful fly fishing is. And it's one of my favorite things to do. And I've had the ability to work in fly shops and kind of be one of the boys and always get that respect immediately from men in a field that is almost entirely dominated by men. You know, we had some great trips and misadventures. Do you remember the Red Canyon Ranch and the sugar fish debacle?
Yes, yes. Your sister and I and you went fishing on the Poposia River right outside the ranch that we were staying at. And I think it was the first time that Becky, your sister, ever caught a fish on a grasshopper fly. And it's pretty exciting when you catch them on a grasshopper fly because they're on the surface and you see the fish take it. And she was able to land it, and it was probably about a 14-inch native trout, and she was so excited that you both wanted to eat it rather than put it back, which is what we usually do. And I agreed, let's do that. First big fish on a grasshopper, and we went back to the ranch that night, and I said I would cook it for you. I thought that I put flour on it, and then fried the fish up and gave it to you guys, and you both started saying how horrible it was. And I realized that I'd put the fish in powdered sugar instead of flour. Then Becky was so mad at me and at the rancher because he kept referring to her sugar fish. And I pretty much ruined the whole experience for you guys. But the fact is, we did get some nice photos of the fish before I dipped it in sugar and screwed it up.
Well, I remember going out and sitting in the car and just being so upset that fish that I was so looking forward to eating
was covered really in sugar. Angry. Yeah, and and you have always had a thing about fish, even as a tiny little kid. Whenever you start eating it, it's like your eyes roll back in your head and you just start shoveling it in. And
that's not very dainty to say about your daughter.
But you've always liked fish.
I do. Yes. I would also like ask how you were kind of affected, not just by those kinds of funny things, but some of the amazing things that we all were able to see and experience together being out in nature.
Well, I mean, they're really important memories. And I can remember a couple of times your sister and I went out very early in the morning, and it was not a good day. It was really heavily, it was fogged in. And we couldn't see very far at all while we were fishing. And I was worried with you guys, that I'd lose you along the river because it was hard to see. But finally, about 10 o'clock, the fog started to lift, and we realized we were surrounded by buffalo, bison, everywhere. And they weren't very far away. And we were kind of cornered by them. And that was just the strangest thing to realize they'd been there all along. We didn't even know it. And that there they were. But I think another Yellowstone thing, I think one of my favorite memories with you and your sister was when we hiked and camped up to Slough Creek in Yellowstone Park and fished that one of the best fishing rivers in the world, where you sight cast for fish. We could see them. We were 8 miles up, and we backpacked in, so we couldn't take a lot of things. But one thing I did take was a Nalgene bottle full of wine. And we were all having, you know, after a long, hot day, all having a little bit of wine. And, you know, the stars are brilliant up there. And it was very clear, warm night. And I remember somebody said, "What was that? What was that?" And we all sat back and got quiet and could hear wolves howling. And I know that was very affecting to all of us to hear that and not have any idea how many there were, how close they were. And, you know, that wasn't that long after they'd been reintroduced. So it wasn't a normal thing in Yellowstone Park. And it reminded us how remote we were.
That I would say that being part of nature and seeing that you're a little part of it is a memory. And it's something that I still take with me today because I love going fly fishing, and I know we try to go on trips as often as we can, and even with my sister, who now doesn't live here anymore, and to all of us connect sometime and still go on those float trips.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
You know what? This has been a lot of fun.
It has been a lot of fun.
And I think we need to go fishing.
I agree.
The piece was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov with interviews recorded at StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives. You can find a longer version of the CJ Box interview on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and other big-time important information, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.